Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel and I'll be your moderator for today's program called Alliance for Smiles, Transforming the Lives of Children Often Left to Die, One Woman's Fight to Overcome the Odds. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my extreme pleasure to introduce our speaker, Anita Stengel. A Bay Area native and graduate of the University of San Francisco, Anita spent over 20 years in the field of education and over 30 years in fundraising and nonprofit management. She started three nonprofit organizations, including Alliance for Smiles, which she co-founded in 2004. Alliance for Smiles sends medical teams to underserved countries to perform free cleft lip and palate surgeries and sets up treatment programs for these children. She was president and CEO until 2016. Now she's a special advisor and CEO for China operations. She's also was president of the San Francisco Rotary Foundation from 2012 to 2017 and chaired many committees which focus on community youth and international service, as well as participating in international medical missions. Will you please welcome Anita Stengel?
Well, this looks like a very friendly audience, so I think I will enjoy talking to you. Some of you know a great deal about Alliance for Smiles, and some of you know very little about Alliance for Smiles and or the cleft palate and lip problem in the world. So I am going to begin by talking a little bit about cleft lip and palate, so you maybe have a little bit more of an understanding. There are a number of organizations, and you've seen a lot of advertisements from organizations that are far bigger than ours, and they talk about doing cleft lip surgery. So, what about cleft lip and palate? There is a myth. The myth is that cleft lip and palate anomalies occur very infrequently. And when I speak to an audience, generally in the United States, they kind of look puzzled and say, but I don't see anybody with a cleft lip and palate. There's a reason for that. The reason, basically, is that in the United States, we have developed, since the 1950s, a comprehensive program that are facilitated by various hospitals, for example, UCSF, that treat children that are born with this anomaly from the time they're born until about the age of 18. So, the children born in the United States are taken care of. The children we treat are not. And there is a greater occurrence of the cleft anomaly in China, Southeast Asia, South and Central America. One in 350 live births involve a cleft child. It's the second most prevalent birth anomaly or defect, you're supposed to use the word anomaly, in the world. And it is serious. In the United States, about 1 in 850 children are affected. In California, because of the large Hispanic and Asian population, it's about 1 in 550. Second myth, and you hear this all the time, a simple half an hour surgery makes everything fine for a patient. I'm sorry. That is an exaggeration. Yes, the first surgery, particularly on a lip, can make a gigantic difference in a child's life. But the treatment is much more complex. And then very, very often, a child has a cleft palate in conjunction with the cleft lip. And this needs to be treated. So when you're looking at really treating the patient, what we are doing in terms of one initial surgery, that's it, is beginning treatment, but it is somewhat palliative because as the child grows, there will still be major issues. We also have another myth which says, oh, we know the reason for a cleft lip and palate. We've identified it. They know that there's a genetic component. Those stats that I just gave you indicate that. They know that in certain families, and I have seen it myself, you have a father that has a cleft, and there are three boys, and they all have clefts. But it can also happen out of the blue. It can happen in the best of circumstances when there's absolutely no history whatsoever in terms of the cleft condition. So the discovery of what treats it is very difficult. Some people have postulated that folic acid given periconceptually can alleviate cleft lip and palate because it is given to prevent spina bifida and neural tube defects in children. But we don't think this is the answer, or else we would try and use more folic acid, obviously. We find that in poor populations, there is a greater occurrence of it. And whether that is due to pollution, which is very, very prevalent in a lot of the countries where we go, whether it is due because there's intermarriage in a small village, and therefore it's a recessive gene, and you end up having the cleft condition occur, there are all sorts of circumstances that affect whether a child could or could not be born with a cleft lip. The other myth is that, oh, forget the palate. Just do the lip and you're going to be fine and everything's going to be okay. Hate to tell you, but an unrepaired palate. Now, a palate is a hole in the roof of your mouth. So when the child tries to eat, a lot of times the food is aspirated. And therefore, they are prone to eustachian tubes becoming infected, therefore hearing loss, therefore chronic bronchitis and asthma, and they are prone to being ridiculed because they will speak funny. If you learn to speak with a hole in your mouth, you will not speak correctly, and people will not understand you. And so these kids go to school, and they sound funny, and they are looked at as mentally retarded when they're not. You know, you think that bullying is just something that is here in America. Bullying occurs everywhere, and a lot of these children have their self-esteem taken away from them because they're bullied by their peers. It's really hard. One of the facts, again, about cleft lip and palate that is not apparent a lot of times to people from the outside, with it being the second most prevalent birth anomaly in the world, 10% of the children are killed at birth. They may be abandoned. They may be put it drowned. They may be just gotten rid of. That came very close to my heart several times. When we were in Wenzhou, China, we did surgery on a little girl. She had been found by migrant workers who were trying to make a living by going through garbage. They found her abandoned in a garbage can, bloodied, umbilical cord still attached, and they rescued her, and we did surgery on her. That is the reality. Now, I'm sorry, I'm a wuss, I cry a lot, but I'm going to try and get through this. One sobering story was that we were in Cameroon, and we had to hire people to recruit patients because when you're in a very, very poor country, people don't believe that there is someone who can help you and that you'll do things free of charge. They just don't. It's not part of what their reality is. So we ended up hiring a recruiter, and he came back with this story, and the person who was our mission director, and remember, we had a mission going at this time where we were treating cleft lip and palate children. She said in her letter, "Hello, friends. I just spoke with Florence." Florence was the major person there to recruit patients. She told me about the man she recruited to help her recruit patients. He has a repaired cleft himself, and so takes his responsibilities very seriously. Every time he hears about a cleft patient, he goes to the village to try and recruit them for surgery. During his recruitment for this mission, he arrived too late in the village of three children who had been killed, destroyed because the cleft was seen as a curse. It is astounding that about 10% of all patients born with clefts worldwide are destroyed. This is very sobering. I shared the news with the team tonight. They were shocked and very sad and angry. Too many emotions. It sure helps put the urgent nature of what we do into the forefront. We do not only change lives, but hopefully will enable us to save lives. For that mission, there was a man who was in Rotary in back east in North Carolina, and his Rotary Club had supported this mission. So she, of course, wrote back to him, and he had been born, as I said, with cleft lip and palate. He wrote an email. Now, I'm going to try and get through this. This is particularly sobering to those who were born with the same anomalies. I cried as I read this email yesterday afternoon after Tina Holcroft forwarded it to me. I was born with a cleft lip and palate in 1959. I was fortunate to be born in this country, to be born to parents here in North Carolina who saw me as a gift and not a curse. I didn't realize that this ever happened, much less today. I told my wife and kids last night that it's difficult to fathom that if I had been born in another place, I too could have been killed and considered a curse. Until this email, I thought you were making people look better. I had no idea you were literally saving lives. So these are the realities. I have to tell you, when I got that email, I sat at my desk and sobbed. It touches your soul. And I think this is the thing about dealing with what we're doing. It touches your soul. Alliance for Smiles was started in 2004. We were founded by six members of the Rotary Club of San Francisco. And one of them is here today, Jim Patrick. I'm one of the founders. And we decided that we wanted to start a program. And we wanted to look at what was being really done well in the area of cleft lip and palate and what needed to be addressed. So we said, the missions are great. We can do missions. We've done missions before with another organization. And we are, you know, we're okay doing that. But we need to do the extra step. Remember in the beginning I told you that the cleft anomaly is long-term treatment. So we set up to figure out how to do treatment centers. We were so fortunate because we enlisted the support of Dr. Karin Bargovic. Dr. Karin Bargovic was the director for the Center on Craniofacial Anomalies at UCSF. And she's passionate about this idea. She has stayed with us this entire time. And through Alliance for Smiles, we have set up treatment centers in China. We are looking to set up treatment centers in Nigeria. And we are looking to also work to set up treatment centers and help in Marrakesh. We are looking to do a trip to Egypt, to Aswan, with the Aswan Sonoma sister city affiliation. And we will therefore also look at setting up centers. We have been in Bangladesh, and we are looking at setting up some centers there. So we are working towards this goal. And let me tell you, this is tough. This is not easy. This is really, really hard work because you have to get the buy-in from a hospital. There has to be the infrastructure in the hospital. There has to be the willingness of doctors to do a lot of this without pro bono, which is foreign to a lot of these people. So we have pushed forward with this idea, and we are working on it on a daily basis. One of the things that I think is important is looking at what we are doing in terms of the bigger world picture. We have done a lot. We have done 103 medical missions. We have recorded over $30 million in donated medical services from our volunteers. We have treated 6,200 patients. We have over 800 volunteers. And this was started in 2004 by six people sitting in an office and saying, what can we do? We were also funded by a shoestring, except for me, who agreed to be the executive director. Each of the other five put in $5,000. So we had $25,000 in seed money. And from that, we grew an organization that could do what I just said. Why do you do it? Why do you put yourself through all of this? We look at our volunteers, and I am in awe of them. Absolutely in awe. Dr. Carl Westrack, where are you? Is the chairman of our board, but he's also a plastic surgeon. And I can tell you the extent of his volunteerism went when last year he was to go to Bangladesh. And we needed him desperately because there was another Middle Eastern surgeon who was supposed to go, but because of government restrictions, and he was from Pakistan, he couldn't get a visa in Bangladesh. So Carl is an astute bike rider, and he ended up falling off of his bike 2 days before. And I got this telephone call from him saying, Anita, I think I threw my shoulder out and hurt myself, but don't worry, I'm going to go. That man went on the trip, did surgery on how many kids, Carl? About 40 kids with a dislocated shoulder and a lot of pain. That is the extent of the volunteerism that is typical. Maybe this is a little outside, but typical of so many of our volunteers. And this is why we have been able to succeed with minimal staff and just a lot of trying to help. And again, one of the things I wanted to say was, what is the reason for what we do? We have an alliance with a lot of Rotarians and a lot of Rotary clubs. And underneath philosophy of a lot of Rotary is the idea of building bridges of international understanding and goodwill. I know that for myself personally, what drives me is not only the desire to make a difference, but the hope that this will help with world peace. You know we are in a very precarious situation in a lot of places. You know that. But when you have volunteers coming and they're interacting with people and respecting them, this is really important. And one of the things that we decided to do was to not go in like a MASH unit and grab everybody and throw the medical people to the side, deal with the immediate cause and leave. No, that's not what we wanted to do. What we wanted to do was to engage the local doctors, to engage the local nurses, and try and make them aware of what we are doing and that we wanted to help them and include them and involve them. This is vitally important. I remember I was on a trip to Bayin. Bayin is really a remote place in the Gansu area, and we were at a hospital, and there had been several medical teams from other, not necessarily cleft lip and palate, but from some other countries. The nurses were literally scared out of their minds because they had been treated so badly. And we came in, and by the end of it, they ended up embracing us. And in fact, what was interesting about Bayin is that for the one city in China that I've been there was no Kentucky Fried Chicken. There was no Starbucks. There was nothing that was Western. It was just Bayin. So the people in the hospital provided lunch for us. And one day they did their version of hamburgers and French fries, just to please us. When you end up having that kind of relationship, you realize that you are respecting people. And I think the fact that you respect people is vital to any kind of a humanitarian engagement. If you don't respect your partners, if you look at them as inferior, and their skill set may very definitely be not what ours is, but you respect them, then you will be able to create these feelings of peace. And that is most important. One of the things that did happen, for example, in terms of these relationships, my sister was very, very ill. And in fact, she passed away during this time. But I got an email, and I was still running the office. I got an email that from our partner in Bangladesh. And asking a question. So I was trying to do everything while being at the hospital and doing everything else. Barbara, who is our major conduit to that country, emailed him back and said, Anita will probably not be able to answer you because your sister is very, very ill. So Rafiq ended up emailing me and saying, Anita, I can't believe that while your sister is so ill, you still took time to answer the question. And it shows your love for our country and our people. And we will all pray for her. It touches your soul. That's not ordinary. That's the idea of international relations, as they should be. What was very, very empowering is just on Monday, I received a forwarded email from our Rotary Club. And it was from Nigeria. And it was from this man in Nigeria who said, my neighbor, who's very, very poor, just had a cleft child born to her 2 weeks ago. I surfed the internet to see if there was any organization that could possibly help. Can you do something to help? So I thought, oh my God, we have great relations in Nigeria. We have this fabulous, fabulous past district governor of Rotary, Dan Deshoga, who has worked like crazy for what we were doing in Nigeria. We are sending a treatment center team to Nigeria, an educational team, in September. So I emailed him back immediately, emailed the person who had written the email. The next morning, I got a thing from Adiende, and he said, I called the man, I saw the telephone number, we have his contact's child lined up for surgery in September. 24 hours to do that. 24 hours, and you can change a child's life. My problem is I always speak too much. I would like to show you a very, very brief video that was compiled for our gala that took place in April. It shows you what we did in this last year, the countries we went to, and some of the situations or pictures of our patients. So please look at it. It's about 4 minutes long, and then I'll be open for questions.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Thank you, Anita Stengel, for your excellent presentation. We'd like to remind our listening and internet audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Alliance for Smiles. And now it's the question and answer period. We have a number of questions from the audience. You talked about the difference between your organization and other organizations, but one question from the audience is if you could elaborate on those differences. I think a lot of people know about different organizations. They may not have heard about Alliance for Smiles. But what is the difference between your organization and other organizations, and do you work together at all?
We really are not working in collaboration with other organizations, except that we have worked with Smile Train in the past. And Smile Train is a very good organization based on the premise that they want to have local doctors perform the surgeries, and they designate Smile Train hospitals, and then they use the funds that they raise to reimburse the doctors for what they're doing. The problem is that there are places a lot of times where you don't have a hospital with the adequate personnel or infrastructure to be able to deliver those surgeries. But we have in the past collaborated with them. Their model changed a little while ago where they're giving a great deal of autonomy to local people who are over a country. And those people, some of them don't want foreign teams in. So you're working with that. We really would love to be able to work more. And I forgot to introduce Allison. Allison is our new executive director. Stand up, Allison. Allison and I will be going to New York, hopefully, to see if we can get an appointment with them to talk again about collaborating with our treatment centers, because that would be great. Some of the economic burden would be dealt with by them.
Yeah. Well, one question from the audience, I think it's a really good question, is what your criteria are when you select a country. You talk about China being the first country.
China was the first country that we went, and we looked at it in certain ways. Number one, is there a need? That's most important. If there's not a need, there's no sense in you going there. Number two, is there an infrastructure that can facilitate the missions? In other words, a lot of times we use Rotary clubs and districts as a way of organizing on site. So they go out and recruit the children. They make the arrangements with the hospital, etc. In China, we had the China Population Welfare Foundation, which is an NGO that works with us. So what we ask of them is, number one, is there a need? Number two, is there infrastructure? Number three, can we make arrangements with a hospital that will provide certain things? Then we list out what they need to do. And most important, can you recruit the patients? This is vitally important, and they can't always. So we send a site visit team to clarify everything, to look at the hospital, to meet with the people who are facilitating the program, and hopefully everything will flow all right. I would say in about 90% of the times it does, or 85% it does, and then there are a few times when it just doesn't work very well.
You talked about a lot of organizations, including yours, that are based in the United States who do work abroad, and how,
right,
in a sense, there's a lack of awareness that there is even an issue, because in this country, like, where are the cleft palates? Where are the cleft lips? Often it takes celebrities to kind of create a bit bigger awareness. I know Stacey Keach is among,
yep,
those who has talked about his life being born with a cleft palate, and how it's a lifelong thing. Can you talk about the importance of maybe getting people like Stacey Keach, but others, to talk about the problem in a bigger way so that people are more aware of it?
Oh, I would love to get somebody like Stacey Keach. I would love to get anybody who can speak to the issue, either being born with it or having a child with it. You know, these are all people who can be real advocates. Unfortunately, we are later, we developed a lot later than some of these other organizations that have captured most of the people who are known and known people who have this problem, this issue. I wish we could get it. And if anybody knows anybody, let me know.
How much of your job is really to educate people? Because you talked in your talk about the cleft lip and then versus the cleft palate. A cleft lip is an obvious outward manifestation of it. And there's this visual sense of, well, if you don't have it outwardly, then you don't have a problem.
Right.
Can you talk about how important it is to educate people before you can even do the job you're doing?
Well, education works on a variety of levels, and one of them is just the interaction you have with your host. And so one of the issues becomes when people are really, really poor, and they've traveled, let's say, 8 hours to get to the hospital and the site. You want to get them back so that they'll at least, if it's a lip, they'll at least have palate surgery the next time that we're there. And sometimes these people just don't see it. My child's taken care of. My child's repaired. And we have always a discussion with a pediatrician after the child is released from the hospital as to what needs to be done and trying to get them back. And that's why you want to go multiple times to one site so that you can offer the follow-up surgery after, you know, one or two surgeries.
One question, I think this is a really interesting question, is what the typical cost of a cleft palate operation is, and what about the follow-up costs? I mean, can you put, in this day and age where there's a lot of metrics involved, is there a sense you can say, well, if you gave us X amount of dollars, we could do X amount of kids?
Absolutely.
So what is that?
Generally, okay, medical missions to different countries cost different amounts. In China right now, we have basically hospital costs and housing for the team and in-country transportation for the team taken care of. In other places, we have to pay for the housing. In Africa, we always have to pay for the housing. We have to pay for certain transportation costs and everything. And please, don't think just because you're staying at what supposedly is a nice hotel in Africa, it's not going to cost anything. It costs more in Africa a lot of times than in the United States per person. And you have to be very, very careful, because safety is an issue. Now, at times, we have stayed free of charge. In Bangladesh, we went to one place, and there was like it wasn't a dormitory, but people had individual rooms, but there was no hot water. So people had to kind of use buckets of hot water to take a shower if they wanted to have any warmth or anything like that. But our team puts up with that, which I think is pretty good. So coming down to the cost, I would say the average cost that we figure is about $1,000 a patient. And there are lots of things, lots of advertisements out there that say for $250, you can change a child's life. I don't believe it. It's a marketing thing. And I mean, I'll go against anyone with, you know, saying that for $250, you can do it. Smile Train, when it began in China, in I think it was about 2002, paid $250 per surgery. Let me tell you, $250 for a surgery given to a hospital and a surgeon is nothing today. Costs have gone up in China. So it depends on the country and it depends on where you are as to what averages out to be the real cost to an organization.
Well, the connection you made rather astutely and compassionately about the link between cleft palates and lips and actually the idea that people will actually kill their kids, mm-hmm. kill their offspring. I thought that was the connection that a lot of people don't make, and people don't make that connection.
They don't make the connection, and it happens because when you're dealing with a very, very poor country and a very superstitious country, a lot of times the added burden of a cleft child is something that is, it's just too much, you know, and it just, they can't handle it. And there is the superstition, again, that the mother did something evil, the father did something evil, the child is born evil, that the child is a curse, and there are all sorts of superstitions about this, and that's one of the other reasons that that happens. And a lot of times they're abandoned to an orphanage. I know that in China, I've been to orphanages in China, and it's very interesting because the only boys that are abandoned are ones that have something physically wrong with them, like a cleft lip or palate or missing an arm or whatever. They're still, even though they're a boy, they've been abandoned to an orphanage.
It reminded me, you mentioned Africa, Cameroon, I think it was. It reminds me of the musician Salif Keita, who's an incredible musician from Mali, who was albino. And being albino in Africa often has a stigma of being
cursed.
You know, cursed, exactly. I'm wondering if in Africa, I know you're starting to do work there.
We have been doing work consistently in various countries, but some of them have the infrastructure for a treatment center and some of them do not. So it just depends.
Why did you start? You started doing work in Marrakesh, right?
Yes.
How did that start? Why did you start doing work in Marrakesh?
Well, very easily. When being a part of the Rotary Club, we always go to the Rotary International Convention and have a booth. And we do it for two purposes. One of those purposes is to see if there could be potential sites. So there was somebody from Marrakesh who came in and wanted us to explore a site. And then Allison got another contact outside of that. And they said that they were very interested in us coming to a pretty sophisticated hospital. And they wanted us to come with a very strong educational team. So we came with that. We had four plastic surgeons and 4 days of education training on a variety of levels. And then we worked with the surgeons there and the other medical people. And then we now have pointed out one particular plastic and reconstructive surgeon that might be able to carry a lot of our work in Marrakesh. We plan to go back, but they also want us to go to the outlying regions where there is maybe more need even for Marrakesh.
We'd like to remind our listening and internet audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Alliance for Smiles. We're talking to Anita Stengel, humanitarian co-founder of the Alliance for Smiles. One other question from the audience, it relates to China. And this question actually could apply not only to Alliance for Smiles, but to a lot of humanitarian organizations. And that is, why isn't China doing more on their own without the intervention of U.S. nonprofits and others?
Well, I think that one of the things is when we began in China, you have to realize we began in 2004 and our first mission was in 2005. China was a very different country at that time. And there was not a national insurance for the most part. And so there was a real need. As time has progressed, and our partners have told us now that they feel that they're taking care of a lot of their own children, what they want out of us now is education and training. And we're happy to do that. And that means that we've been a success in China. And I agree with you. I think China is at a different point now than it was before. And I think probably for some of their things that they need basically mentors, education, training, rather than hands-on medical missions. But I know there are other things. I know there's a Rotary Club in Hong Kong, and we get donations from Hong Kong Rotary Clubs. But they're dealing with a major problem in China on the leper colonies because China doesn't want to acknowledge that there are any leper colonies. So, you know, you're still dealing with human beings. You can say to a country, well, you should do this, but sometimes if the country doesn't do it and you can help, you do because you're dealing with human beings.
Well, you talked very passionately about the reasons that you and others in your organization care about the work you do. But I imagine in terms of fundraising, you have to fundraise from people who may be new to the issue.
Yes.
And one question from the audience relates to how you get people to actually care about problems, about these problems. Do you have to start from zero? How do you appeal to people here in the United States who have the potential to fund something, you know, wherever?
It is person to person. It is getting the message out. We have some great supporters in Georgia. And 10 years ago, they started with a little party in their area, and it's a pretty affluent area, Lake Oconee. And so they started with this little thing and began raising funds from some of the friends, etc. They continued, and I went to their party this last year, very simple. It was potluck in an outside pavilion in one of the gardens, but they had over 100 people, and she raised $40,000. So that's the way it grows. Now, the challenge is to get people who will make some major donations, and that is one of the things that we're trying to work with our board of directors, as most organizations do, and it's a struggle. It's very definitely a struggle. We have great supporters, and they do get the word out. Now, what Allison has done since she's come in has been a program to develop social media. So we're on social media a lot more. But as you know, getting support out of social media is not a slam dunk. It's not a one-day thing. And so it is always that you're trying to get the word out. You try and speak. We speak before a lot of Rotary clubs. We have gotten a lot of global grants through Rotary, and that has supported a lot of our work. But, you know, we have a gala. We have an annual campaign. We do all the stuff that other nonprofits do in order to try and raise funds.
I want to ask you a personal question because it's almost like you take for granted your involvement with the Alliance for Smiles, and you know, I describe you as a humanitarian, which I think is completely accurate. But how did you, if you could talk a little bit about your road to your humanitarianism? In 1987, you became one of the first women to join the Rotary Club.
Right.
So you're breaking barriers that way. In some sense, people can look at your history and say, well, of course it makes sense to your work with Alliance for Smiles. But for those who don't know you, it makes no sense. So if you could just help people make sense of that, like your story.
Well, I was in education, and I taught high school English and acting full-time for 16 years and then started the development office at that school for the next 6 years. When the school, unfortunately, closed, it was Presentation High School here in San Francisco. And so when it closed, I looked at maybe some other nonprofits, and I was involved with one as the executive director for a year, and that didn't work out. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to get out of the nonprofit venue, and I'm going to start a business. So I got everything together to start a little business. And my heart wasn't in it. It just wasn't. And the opportunity to volunteer for some of these projects came up, and I volunteered. That's all I can say. I was sold. And there's nothing, the other stuff doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. When you can look and you can say, my work is affecting people's lives, and you feel good about yourself. When I turned 40, I was absolutely lambasting myself. I said, I've done nothing. I haven't made a mark on the world or whatever. I think I have. So that's self-gratification. So there's a lot of self-gratification in here. Don't be mistaken.
I appreciate you saying that. I think the audience does as well. So you've been in this line of work for many, many years, and we talked about how people may not know anything about the issue. You mentioned at the outset that there are a lot of misconceptions about even how one gets a cleft palate, you know, whether it's genetic or not. You said there's still really no formidable research about that. There's no way to tell. I'm wondering, you know, doing my own research for this, it seems like there are some factors where people can kind of manage, as it were, to kind of try to limit the chances of having a cleft palate.
Well, the intermarriage factor and the fact that there is a genetic predisposition among certain races and ethnic groups, et cetera. But, you know, in talking about trying to examine things, in my physical therapist office, there is one of the therapists is married to a woman who's working at UCSF in trying to do experiments on mice that might turn up the genetic component for cleft lip and palate. So they're still at that stage, and they still have not found out exactly what causes it. You know, so, you know, the research continues, thank God, because it would be wonderful if we could be in a world free of cleft lip and palate, but it's a very long journey.
Another question from the audience. If there's a genetic inheritable aspect, as you know, applying the principle of do no harm, what can be done to address that aspect of balancing the greater good with the no harm aspect?
Wow. What do you mean? Do you have any idea what he means or she means by greater good with no harm in aspect? I don't quite understand that.
Does the person who asked that... Oh, yes, please.
Yeah. In other words, addressing it in such a way that doesn't stigmatize anybody, but also addresses the problem and seeks to find a solution.
Well, I think I understand what you're talking about. I don't know whether you know this or not, but in Taiwan, there is a very prestigious academy, the Nordhoff Center. And it was established by a missionary from the United States. One of the things that he saw was that at that time, there was a prevalence of cleft lip and palate. So he went back and got his plastic surgery degree and came back to Taiwan. And this is many years ago, when Taiwan was not nearly as affluent as it is today. He began this center, which does training, education. He's fantastic. It's a phenomenal center, and I visited it. But one of the things he found out was that even after surgery, even after or while children were being treated, there still was the hands-off sort of thing in terms of the general population. So he created an education program for the general populace, which was to explain cleft lip and palate, to make them understand, and to try and really help with this anomaly, which I think is great. In Wenzhou, China, our partners there, which is a phenomenal group of people, have started a camp for a week or 2 weeks in the summer with cleft children who are teenagers, so that they can talk to one another and figure out what's happening and try and be supportive towards one another. I would like to see that sort of thing appear in a lot more places, and it's a lot more work for us to be involved in doing it. Does that answer your question? Okay.
The stigma you're talking about that's been talked about, we talked about how it's maybe different in Africa versus China. But even, for example, in Egypt, you talk about Aswan, How is the cleft palate or lip looked at differently there than, say?
No, not necessarily. I mean, what it is look at this. The first thing you see is a person's face, okay? And there's a lot of judgment that goes on immediately in terms of how that person looks. When you have poverty and you have people that are really, really poor and they see a child and it has this anomaly, in a lot of these countries, the child is abandoned. And that happened in China to that little girl, and it happens in Africa, and it happens in other places as well. Poverty plays a big role in the treatment of cleft lip and palate children.
Well, it begs the next question. I mean, so much of the kind of fundraising and the awareness around cleft palates and lips is around children. But for those who don't get the operation, then I imagine there are a lot who don't, who have to live their lives, you know, however long it is, right? Is there, for example, a way for people in their teens or even, you know, 20s to get operations still?
We do it.
Yeah?
Can you talk about it.
What the difference is between someone
I who, wish we had. Do you don't have a picture of Bernie, do you? Okay, I wish for this is our stellar example. When we were in the Philippines, there was this woman who was our liaison, and she owned a plantation, and we were doing surgery, and somebody said to her, "Don't you realize that you have somebody with a cleft anomaly working on your plantation?" And they said, "No, but bring him in." So he came in, and there is a before picture of him. And if you look into his eyes, the eyes really tell, particularly on the older people, they were dead. And he was very severely deformed, and he had always worn a bandana across his face so that people wouldn't see him. Well, we ended up doing surgery on him. Unfortunately, most of his teeth were rotted out, so I think they pulled most of them. And when he got off of the surgery table, they held a mirror in front of him, and he didn't recognize himself. And they came back a year later, and somebody had gotten him dentures and everything, and the picture of him, he's handsome. So he has a life ahead of him. And so for these adult people that have suffered a lot, you know, there is some hope to have some of the surgery later. Now, with palates, it's different. Because sometimes, and there is discussion that later on in life, if you hit somebody in their 20s or even 30s, to do the palate surgery is not going to make that big of a difference. But there is a medical debate on that, so it's not a closed question. But we can help older people. We have helped older people. And I didn't read you this one letter that I have here, which was from one of our patients who was 22 years old, who had had a preliminary surgery, but didn't, you know, needed more surgery. And she came to our team, and we gave it to her, and she was absolutely thrilled and important to be made to feel normal, you know? And I mean, one of the people that we did surgery on, and this is a story that is amazing, and we don't have her picture because she was so deformed with more than just the cleft lip and palate. And she came to our team in China with her father. And I think she was about 4 years old. Sweet little girl, not mentally retarded. And he had gone all over China to try and see if somebody would do surgery on her. And the head plastic surgeon, Gagan, who is absolutely phenomenal, said, "I have to do surgery on this child." And I think it took him about 5 hours to do the initial surgery. Then she came back for another surgery, and I think that was the palate. And then she came back for another surgery, which, again, was a very difficult surgery. We now have a little girl that does not look normal, but she's not a monster.
Yeah, and these are really, really super touching stories. I mean, the statistics you cited in your talk earlier about the number of children born with cleft palate or cleft lip. Can you remind us of that? Because I think it's like in the U.S. it's 1 in 1,000 maybe?
No, in the United States it's 1 in 850. In California, because of the large Asian and Hispanic population, it's 1 in 550. In China, Southeast Asia, South and Central America, and if you can think that there might have been a migration at one time across the ocean from China to South America, it's 1 in 350.
So is it fair to say that today there are, you know, a million people, 500,000? I mean, sorry to reduce it to that, but I'm just curious.
I don't have that statistic, but I think, you know, if you're talking about China with 40,000 and, oh, there, he got Bernie up.
For those listening online, we're watching an incredible image that shows before and after. Yeah, that's absolutely incredible. Well, so I'm wondering if there's even you talked about the these groups of people that were people, let's say young people who have cleft lips or palates can be amongst themselves, right, and to kind of bond and you know, and do such things. Are there organizations that allow them to do this online, where sort of like a Facebook?
I think we need to look into that, and we haven't looked into it, to tell you the truth. I don't know if there are other organizations that might do that, but I don't think so. But Allison, it's something else we can look at.
We have time for really just one more question, and looking at this last question from the audience, is there a genetic component? Are you aware, is there any identifiable ground zero?
No, and there's no identified gene, there's no identified genome, they haven't gotten it yet, and that's what they're trying to get. Because once you can identify that, you might be able to create a treatment, but at this point of time, We don't have it.
Well, we do have your organization. We do have lots of other organizations, and I want to thank you so much for your time today. And I want to for those listening online, I want to tell you that this has been a Commonwealth Club program called Alliance for Smiles. We were speaking with Anita Stengel, humanitarian and co-founder of the Alliance for Smiles. We want to thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel. You've been listening to a Commonwealth Club program, and now with this Commonwealth Club of California meeting celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.